Dargrave Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn Semester 2009. This is Business Finance FIL 240, Section 6. Lecture 22, delivered on November 10, 2009. The title of this lecture is Break-Even Analysis, Optimal Capital Structure, and the M&M Proposition.
Today, Break-Even Analysis, Optimal Capital Structure, and the M&M Proposition. Now, break-even analysis is a very easy subject, and I had asked you if you had seen it before, and a number of you affirmed, yes, I have seen this before. And we usually do this in a pre-calculus kind of math class. You can do it in a calculus kind of way, too, but it's not that tough. Let me show you an example. The question here is, how much do we have to sell in order to start to make a profit on our business? And that's going to be critically dependent upon our level of fixed costs versus our variable costs. Now, I'm going to bring up a couple of formulas. Total cost is the variable cost plus the fixed cost. Nothing complicated about that at all. Variable costs vary with sales. Fixed costs don't vary with sales. They're upfront. They are there whether you sell no units or a billion units. Those are your fixed costs. As I said, if you go through an accounting statement, you can try to pick out, well, that would be a fixed cost, that would be a variable cost, that would be a fixed cost. Interestingly enough, though, if you do it that way, and then if you go back and do it more of a mathematical way, you'll find that the numbers don't come out to be the same. And I can speak to this in sort of a real-world situation. When I ran businesses, there were costs that were actually kind of like a combination of a fixed and a variable cost. So on an accounting statement, I might write down my utilities as an expense line. But really, those utilities were a blend of a fixed cost and a variable cost. So I couldn't see that on the accounting statements, but it really was the case. My lights would be on in my office whether or not I had any consulting gigs or not. But there would be things that would be going on. My computers would burn harder. My printers would run. My faxes would run. My phones, that's another bill. But there would be some of those costs some part of that cost would rise as my business operation increased. So it's not enough to just go through the accounting statement as the book kind of implies and just say, well, here's variable, here's fixed. It's a little more complicated than that. But we can actually tease out statistically, if we have to, with some relatively easy statistics, what are the variable costs and what are the fixed costs of operation. Now, so I could say, well, the total cost in terms of output of the firm is some variable cost V, C, times the output level Q, plus some flat amount, some fixed cost amount. And that VC, what is that? That's kind of an important thing to know about. What is our variable cost? Now, profit, not surprisingly, is our total revenue minus our total cost. Profit is total revenue minus total cost. Well, total revenue is our price of our product times how much of it we sell. And our total cost, I'm going to break up into this VC times Q plus FC. So I can write profit in this way. Now I'm going to do a little rearrangement here and say, okay, our profit is P times Q and distributing that minus sign through, that'll be VC times Q minus FC, distributing that minus sign through that little thing there. Now I'm going to recollect my terms here a little bit. I'm going to recollect my terms here, factoring out the Q. So I would say that P minus VC as a quantity times P minus VC as a quantity times Q minus FC is our profit. Now I'm going to stop here and make a terminological point. Traditionally, that P, the price minus the variable cost per unit, we call that profit margin. And in other contexts, you'll hear profit margin mean something else. But in this context, price minus variable cost is our unit margin. It's our unit margin. It's how much we are clearing on each unit before fixed costs have to be taken care of. It's how much we're clearing on each unit. So our break-even, the output, break-even output, and I will write that as a Q sub BE, would be the place where the profit is zero, where we have hit a zero profit. So that would be zero is P minus VC times Q minus FC. And I'm going to just rearrange this so that we can find the break even. That's that Q there, by the way, is not just any Q, that's our break even Q. That's our break even Q. This is our goal line, at least in terms of being able to survive to the next period. That's what we have to do. That's how much we have to sell if we don't want red flowing at the bottom of the financial statement. So if I rearrange this, that would be FC is P minus VC times Q sub BE. So I can write fixed costs over unit margin, P minus VC, is our break-even output. That's our break-even. That is how much it's going to take us to be able to use black ink on the bottom line of our financial statement. Notice how as fixed cost rises, the break-even rises. Notice how as price rises, break-even falls. But notice how as variable cost rises, break-even rises. So, using that as our background to do this, and avoiding the little thing that I was trying, point that I was going to make that I somehow didn't make here. Let's take a couple of companies. Let's look at, and I'm going to hold as many things as I can constant here on these. I'm going to say, well, okay. Suppose that I were to say, company A and company B both make and sell a product at a unit price of $2.50. So we're holding the price of the product constant. Now, company A has fixed costs of $50,000 and a unit variable cost of $1.25. While company B has fixed costs of $10,000, but unit variable cost of $2.25. Now, you can do this a lot of different ways, but again, you've seen me do this before. I like to put together pieces of a puzzle and then put the larger pieces together to get my final answer. Look, I'm going to just write a little quick information here that might be useful to me. Company A and Company B in two columns. Now, one thing that I'm going to write right now is unit margin. Maybe just for my own purposes, but it's good to see this. Unit margin, which would, of course, be unit margin is P minus VC. So the unit margin on Company A here, the unit margin on Company A, well, that would be $2.50 price minus a variable cost of $1.25. So Company A has a unit margin of $1.25 on its product. But Company B has a price of $2.50 per unit on its product and variable cost of $2.25. So the unit margin for Company B is only 25 cents. It's a low margin company. It's a low margin company. And you might have even heard that term before. Certainly in your life you will at some point. This is Company B is a low-margin company. Company A is a higher margin company. So we'd obviously think to ourselves, oh, well, Company A is probably going to be a better company. And let's go through and just get a break-even. Break-even output. And that, of course, we can do that one as nothing but Q break-even is the fixed cost over the margin, unit margin. And that's kind of why I did that, got that unit margin. So now all I have to do is say, well, Company A has a $50,000 fixed cost over a unit margin of $1.25. Company B has a fixed cost of 10,000 units, a fixed $10,000 over a margin of $1.25. And if you work those two numbers out, 50,000 over 1.25 comes out to be 40,000. And do make sure you can do this. 40,000 units. Company B breaks even at 40,000 units, but strangely, Company A breaks at 40,000 units, and Company B breaks at 40,000 units as well. So kind of an odd thing, the two companies with substantially different fixed costs and what we would assume would be different degrees of operating leverage as a result, nevertheless have the same break-even point. But here's the thing. Here's the point that I'm trying to get to here. Let me draw the graphs of these two companies all on one axis system. And here, on the vertical, on the horizontal axis, I'm going to draw output. And on the horizontal axis, I will write profit. Now, humor me here for just a moment. I'm going to write the profit equation for each of these companies. The profit equation for Company A would be P minus VC, the unit margin times output minus fixed cost of $50,000. 1.25Q minus 50,000. It's just a plain old linear equation. profit margin, C over here, profit margin times Q minus fixed costs. Just a linear equation. And I'm going to do the same here for the profit for company B. It, that would be P minus VC, which in this case is 0.25, times Q minus $10,000. So those are the two equations I'm going to graph. And there's a point to this. Okay, I'm going to do company B in one color and company A in another color here. And I'm going to just do 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 10, 20, 30, 50, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 80, 90, 1,000. And this is actually not going to be hard to graph these, because the profit, this equation right here, this profit equation, I've got 2 points on it. I know its y-intercept is at negative $50,000. And I know that the point 40,000, comma, zero is on it. Because the break-even, where profit was zero, was at 40,000 units. So I've got this point on its graph too. Believe me, I don't want to. You could plug in points and all that, but why do it if I've got two obvious points already? So the profit equation of company A looks like this. That's the profit equation of company A. Now, company B, its profit equation is profit equals 0.25 minus 10,000. So company B has a y-intercept of 10,000, but it also, 40,000 comma zero is on that guy too. So I've got 2 points on that one instead of having to calculate points and make a table or something like that, I can draw that. And there you see the two profit equations. And again, all I'm doing is just essentially graphing y equals mx plus b lines from your dark days of slope-intercept, except the y-intercept is always an easy point to graph, and since I did the break-even, I know that profit is zero at 40,000 units for both of those companies. So there are my two profit equations. Now, notice something interesting about these two companies. First of all, they both have the same break-even point, but notice that the profit margin, which is the slope, ensures that B will not make huge profit as it grows past, as its sales grow past break even. A is going to make a lot more profit as on each unit that it sells after it breaks even. So once A has cleared break even, it will be making lots of profit compared to B, which will be making considerably less profit on each unit and overall on its units after it has cleared break-even. Now, is there a point to this? Yes. It's not exactly the point that perhaps most financial people would want to make. Which is a better company for you? Which is a better company? Looks like A. Well, yeah, you would think that would, it's almost like an obvious. Well, duh. Yeah, A is a better company. A is preferable. However, think about this. Suppose that we don't break even. Which company would have a better probability of surviving to the next period? The one that had only a few grand in fixed costs that it hadn't covered, or the company that is way more in the hole? Look here. Suppose that we, in the first period of analysis, the company sells only 10,000 units. Look at the profit of B. It's got a negative profit, obviously. But look at the profit of A. Considerably worse. Yeah, you get a very nice thing happening once you have broken even. But at the same time, you've got to look at worst case scenarios. In this case, this company is not going to be in nearly as much trouble in a worst case scenario as A was. Moreover, there is a very rapid rise in your profit margin. That's wonderful. But sometimes that's not the best idea. Let's take an example. Have any of you ever been to a Dollar Tree store? They kind of suck. But you would think to yourself, how in God's name would a store like this survive? I go to Dollar Tree all the time. There are not many people in the store at any given time, and the people in there are very undesirable to be around. They like to talk to you, and their kids like to wipe their snotty noses on your leg. But at the same time, think about this. Suppose that you had a company, and you had a store like a Dollar Tree. Now, suppose that Dollar Tree store made only a profit, after it paid its sorry-ass workers, after it paid its miserable light bills, its profit on any given day was only $30. You'd say, oh, that sucks. That really sucks. Now multiply that store, one store, by 5,000 units in the chain. Suddenly, 5,000 times $30 for each store, 5,000 stores, suddenly you have $150,000 a day in profit across your little chain of stores in the United States, Canada, and better parts of Mexico. Do you see the point there? And also notice something else. What happens in that store versus in that company? Versus a company that has only one store, but it makes the one store makes $150,000 a day. Okay, now, suppose that something bad happens to one store in each company's network. One store in the company's network, the Dollar Tree, it's lost $30 of profit. One store in that one store chain that made the same amount of profit per day, that's the entire profit margin of the company. So you see the point there. Sometimes it's not the company that does the Hail Mary that's the genius. And I'll tell you right now, some of these miserable stores like Dollar Trees, especially Aldi's, I mean, I've already told you, I hate Aldi's. I don't like to buy where they throw my food in boxes on the floor. But think about the genius of it. The market knows that genius. They reward Aldi's. Aldi's is a perennial love child of the market, because even though any given store in the chain makes a miserably small profit, it is so many stores that there is like a smoothing effect across that entire network on any given day. The profit will stay very level because there are so many stores. So the bumps of one store or even 10 stores don't affect the entire margin of the entire chain. So even though it looks obvious that A is the better company, not necessarily. And also notice something else interesting, and I will go to my grave. I was going to show you the math of it, but I'm not even going to try right now. If I were to look at the degree of operating leverage of these two stores, Company A and Company B here, Company B has lower fixed costs. Therefore, Company B is going to have a lower degree of operating leverage. It's going to be a lower risk enterprise. And so even though it looks like its profit margin is not very attractive to investors, it is indeed worthy because it is a lower risk company. Their lower risk is going to give a lower expected return. So there's no reason to believe that company B is inferior from what I've given you here to company A. And in fact, a lot of investors are going to prefer a company B to a company A, especially if they are quite risk averse investors. Because this company B, it's got $10,000 to clear before it breaks even. Company A, it's got $50,000 to clear before it breaks even. So keep that in mind when you are out there thinking about the business that you are going to form and become the next Bill Gates or the next Warren Buffett. Think about, well, not always is the Hail Mary the best idea. Now I'm going to go on here to something. I brought up the idea of the degree of operating leverage, which takes us back to the world of risk. Leverage is risk. I'm going to kind of come full circle in the course here a little bit. There was a proposition that was made, I think it was actually before my time, maybe not. For some reason, the data is escaping me right now. But there were these two academics, Modigliani and Miller. Modigliani and Miller. And we oftentimes call them M&M, as opposed to M&M, the alphabet house, Marshall McLuhan. This is M&M, Modigliani, and Miller, the two theoreticians. Now, they laid out some reasonable assumptions about capital structure and about the costs of the different components of capital structure. Now, you did this. You remember that ugly work with weighted average cost of capital and then marginal cost of capital. And you saw that debt is cheaper than equity. All other things being equal, debt is cheaper than equity. No doubt about it. And there are two reasons for that. One is that debt is tax deductible. So that makes it cheaper for a company to have debt right off the bat. Your dividends are not, you can't deduct your dividends from your taxable income as a business. You can't. They're almost like candy you're just throwing to investors for one reason or another. Okay. And then there's another reason that debt is cheaper than equity. Debt gets the first claim on the income, on the operating income, EBIT. So if there is any money to be handed out, the debt holders are going to get theirs first. If the company goes tap city, the debt holders can walk into the court and carve up the company. The equity holders are gone. They're done. They lose everything. The debt holders write the rules in a bankruptcy. They can say yes or no to any workout proposal, or they can just end the life of the company. Debt is going to be safer. Therefore, it will be cheaper for a company to issue debt than it will equity. Well, here's what Modigliani and Miller said, and they did some mathematics with it, but it's almost like a duh. Okay, if debt is cheaper than equity, every corporation should be 100% debt. Why would you ever issue equity if it's more expensive than debt? Why would you do that? If debt is cheaper than equity, what would possibly motivate a company to ever issue one share of common stock? Why wouldn't every corporation be 100% debt? Therefore, the optimal capital structure of a corporation should be 100% debt, 0% equity, period. The minute you start taking on equity, your cost of capital goes up. Your weighted average cost of capital goes up, period. There should be no company in the United States that should have any equity whatsoever, because optimal capital structure should be 100% debt. And I hate to do this, but here's a big hint. That's a classic, a wonderful one-liner, write-it-out questions or the exam. You remember those ugly things from the first exam? So you might want to remember this. Hint, hint. Nudge, nudge. Wink, wink. It's a good question for that part of the exam, the write-out, okay? Yeah, put a big fat ass star on that one. I mean, that's such a classic. Here's the thing. Okay. You and I both know there really aren't any ghosts, right? You know that paranormal stuff is just absolutely ridiculous. It really is. And, you know, it's fun to talk about, do the Ouija boards, and I do that kind of weird stuff. It's, you know, it's just fun. It actually works to get girls sometimes, you know, let's go look at Ouija boards. You know. Oh, really? You're cool. No, anyway. But, okay, no, we don't believe in this. I mean, we all know this is ridiculous, like UFOs and all that kind of stuff. And Loch Ness monsters and the Chupacabra and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, you go into this house and they say, you know, this is a haunted house. Oh, Stephen King's going to write about me after I've been in here. And you know very well there aren't any ghosts. You walk into the house, the door slams behind you, and then a giant ghost with ugly teeth and ectoplasm drooling out of it says, "Get out!" Now, you got your certain knowledge there are no such things as ghosts. And then there is this ghost standing there, just oozing ectoplasm, making a mess, and you're going to have to get some really, really high antibacterial soap because you don't know what kind of bacteria those things have, and wash yourself. There it is right in front of you. Okay? So this is a thing that happens sometimes in theory, is that we don't mean for our conclusion to prove that the world is wrong. What we actually intend is to say, okay, our results say this. Our results are logically consistent from reasonable assumptions that everyone can agree with, and yet what we see in the real world is not what we are seeing at the end of our nice academic paper. So, why are we seeing something different? You look at the world around you, corporations, there are corporations everywhere that have stock. I did in this semester, optimal capital structure is 75% equity and 25% debt. Well, that's not unusual. That's certainly out there all over the place. Companies sweat. Financial analysts do a lot of work calculating optimal capital structure. Well, I think it's about 55% equity and 45% debt. They even go through public offerings or they issue debt just to get back to this optimal capital structure that includes both equity and debt and equity. So why are we seeing something in the real world that doesn't fit with the perfectly reasonable assumptions of the Modigliani-Miller proposition? Why is it that companies issue equity if it is more expensive than debt? Why do we do that? Why are corporations irrational? Well, first of all, no, corporations are not irrational. And this whole idiocy and mania about bubbles notwithstanding and the irrational exuberance of that mindless fool that used to be the Federal Reserve chairman. No, we're not irrational in business. We're out to make a profit. We don't do things irrationally. We might not have enough information to do the best, but we're sure as hell not irrational. Why are we issuing equity if it is more expensive than debt? There are a couple of reasons. Oh, well, there are a couple of possible reasons. I point one out, by the way. Now, I'm going to tell you the standard model. And this is the one that the book talks about, too. And then I'm going to give you another one that the book doesn't mention. But the other one, I don't think I would ever want to write a paper about it because I'd be shot down academically. But I think my other one is part of the answer. Look, first of all, remember when we did the marginal cost of capital? As you take on more debt, you're increasing your financial leverage. Okay? Debt increases financial leverage, all other things being held constant. Increased financial leverage is increased risk. So at some point, the lenders are going to say, you're getting awfully risky borrowing all this money, so we're going to have to ask for a better return. Yeah, it was great when you had $100,000 at the EBIT and your interest payments were $10,000. You had a times interest earned of 10. But now you are in a position where you want to raise your debt limit, and now it's going to be $90,000 of interest on $100,000 of EBIT. Well, that scares the crap out of us, because if your sales deviate just a little bit, you're in default. So we're going to want a lot more reward for taking on that kind of risk. What that indicates is that, as we saw, in the marginal cost of capital exercises, as your level of debt goes up, your lender is going to sooner or later say, we're going to have to charge you more for the next dollar we lend you. So debt will not stay forever cheaper than equity. Because there's one thing about equity that is not true about debt. With equity, it means you never have to say you're sorry. If I don't pay my shareholders a dividend, you know, at the end of the day, I can write them, well, we're trying to get back to a position where dividend policy can offer us the opportunity to send you a dividend check. But you know what, underneath the surface, we're saying, kiss my ass. What are you going to do about it if you don't get a dividend check? Nothing. Oh, you'll come to the shareholders meeting and you'll scream and you'll say, well, we're going to vote the directors out. But hey, the direct insiders hold the majority of the stock, so whatever you say, it doesn't matter in the end. You know, that's the end of the story. But if you say that to the debt holders, oh, I'm sorry, we can't pay you an interest payment this month. Well, they'll be right down there in the court with their suits on, and they will hang your ass and put you into Chapter 11. You see, there's the thing, is that with debt, you have to pay them. With equity, at the end of the day, you don't have to pay them. You don't have to give them a damn dime. So there's going to be a point where if you take on too much debt, it is going to get riskier than the equity you're handing out. So that means that somewhere along the line, the cost of debt will go above the cost of equity. So that was where the Modigliani and Miller, and they were not stupid, they're good academics, they were trying to do was get illicit out. That our basic assumption that we start out with, debt is cheaper than equity, well, that's not exactly correct. It depends upon where you are in your capital structure. At some point, as you're heading for 100% debt, you're going to get into a very bad situation where you have gotten so risky that if your sales deviate just a little bit from your expectations, you're underwater and you're in bankruptcy. So that's where we are in this Modigliani-Miller kind of idea. It's important for us to understand that Modigliani and Miller simply pointed out, look, it's cheaper to issue debt than it is equity, therefore we should see optimal capital structure at 100% debt. So in the Modigliani-Miller world, okay, percent debt on the x-axis and the cost of capital, the weighted average cost of capital, as we get towards 100% on the percent of debt, we would go from some very high level where here would be the cost of 100% equity, which would be case of S, down till this point right here, which would be the after-tax cost of debt. That would be what the weighted average cost of capital would basically look like. As you pulled away from equity and went towards debt, at 100% equity, you'd pay the cost of equity. At 100% debt, you pay the cost of debt. And so it would be pretty much a straight line drop. And Clueville should call you on the phone and say, hello, cheapest, 100% debt. But in the real world, it doesn't look like that. What it actually looks like is something in a smooth kind of way. If I were to look at percent of debt and then the WAC, and I think I showed you this one before, the weighted average cost of capital would be, sure enough, just like Modigliani and Miller say, as you bring debt into the portfolio, it first of all lowers your weighted average cost of capital because it's cheaper than equity. But at some point, debt begins to get more expensive because you're putting too much risk in the company. Your financial leverage has gotten to the point where lenders are saying, this is getting a little scary. Your times interest earned is getting a little too close to one for our taste. So we're going to start charging you more for debt. And that means that as you move towards more debt, it's going to get more expensive. So the real weighted average cost of capital has this U-shape, like the average cost curves you saw in economics. You remember these in economics? Kind of in your dark, ugly past, they had that horseshoe shape. This is going to be the same thing. And then the marginal cost of capital is going to be a sweeping line. The marginal cost of capital will drop at first as you increase your debt. But eventually, what's going to happen is as you put more debt into the portfolio, you're going to go through those breakpoints, more and more of those breakpoints as you rise on the debt. If you just keep using more and more debt, your breakpoints, you'll just keep stacking up those debt breakpoints, one after the other after the other, and your marginal cost of capital is just going to whip up. And that's what's going to pull the weighted average cost of capital up, because your marginal cost of capital is rising because of those breakpoints you're hitting on the debt. And that will pull your weighted average cost of capital up. So the upshot is that there is an optimal capital structure most of the time that we see in the real world, where there is some percent of debt, optimal amount of debt, and an percentage of debt, optimal percentage of debt, and optimal percentage of equity. There is a nice sweet spot. And if there really is a sweet spot like this, and we can do some statistical analysis and some financial analysis to kind of get a good idea of where it is, we're going to stick to that place. We're going to stick to it and see what we can do to hold our capital structure around that. Now, where is that? Interestingly enough, if you want to talk about it empirically, there's no one size fits all. And this is actually just kind of an economics exercise. You're going to see different weighted average cost of capital shapes, especially in the long run. There will be some companies which are much better to run mostly on equity, very, very small percentage of debt. Then there will be other companies that can handle a much higher percentage of debt in their capital structure. Now, what would be the difference? Kind of hard to say. One thing that I would speculate, and this is pure speculation, is that if you've got a company that's already heavy on degree of operating leverage, I would suspect that that's a company that wouldn't want to stack onto that a whole lot of financial leverage too. So a company that was high in fixed costs, well, that might kind of worry me that it was also high in interest cost too. So I might see that kind of a company speculatively maybe having a lower percentage of debt. A company that is light on operating leverage, well, that's a company that could afford to handle more financial leverage for a degree of combined leverage. That these two companies actually might have the same degree of combined leverage. But one would be having its combined leverage coming from operating fixed costs, so its leverage in financial terms would have to be low. This company, light on fixed costs, so its degree of operating leverage is low, could afford more, a larger percentage of debt. It's hard to say. But there's one thing that I did want to go back to. Last point. When we ask about, okay, let's go back to Modigliani and Miller. Set aside marginal cost of capital and all that, and how it goes up. logically, we should see companies always buy the do the cheapest thing. We should see people do the cheapest thing. And so if the Modigliani and Miller world really does apply, then we would certainly expect all companies to be 100% debt because debt is cheaper than equity. Now, let's try this. Sir, do you always buy the cheapest product at the store? What, aren't you rational? You should obviously buy the cheapest. Don't buy the Charmin. Buy the sandpaper special. Don't buy the milk that has a label on it. Buy the milk that when you shake it, it kind of goes ka-chunk, ka-chunk. It's cheaper, even though it's a little chunky inside. Don't buy fancy underwear. Buy the cheapest possible brand. And as far as beer goes, why buy the expensive stuff when Herb Light will get you blottoed? I mean, the point is to get shit-faced. So why buy Chateau Neuf de Derrière wine when you can buy Mad Dog and get the same effect considerably more quickly? So what's the matter? Why don't you always buy the cheapest? It's hard to say, isn't it?
I like better products.
Yeah. Like what?
I like better products.
Well, la-dee-da. No, but do you see the point I'm making there? We're not irrational. People aren't irrational. That's one of those things that we leave to the idiots in the news and all that, sociologists. Well, there's such an irrationality. No, we do things for reasons. And sometimes our reasons aren't clear to us. And sometimes we don't have all the information that we should have that would give us a better decision. I mean, Lord knows, surely some of you have read the Darwin Awards, know about the Darwin Awards. Some of you are looking at me. You know the Darwin Awards, the ones that are given out to people who've done something. They get an award because they've killed themselves, and that takes their stupid out of the gene pool. Some of those are amazing stories. But people don't do things irrationally. We don't always buy the cheapest product. That's not because we're irrational. It's because there is something else motivating us besides price. And I'll hit this just obvious. Do you always buy the cheapest? Hair care products. Your hair looks nice. Do you buy the stuff that's $1 a bottle? You don't. No, you don't. I mean, you're going to get those glasses at Walmart. Did you get your glasses at Walmart? Of course not. I don't think you, well, maybe you did. No, you didn't get those glasses at Walmart. No, but they're cheaper. Half as much expense. So why aren't we doing the cheapest thing? Go ahead.
Probably 50% quality and 50% status conscious.
Oh, now there's an interesting thing. There's a status. You know, it's really embarrassing to go to the store and have people notice that in your shopping cart is an awful lot of generic stuff. But there. I'm not too proud. At Walmart, everyone buys generic. But, you see, you're right, though. There is something that is conveying a message. And it's possible that part of why companies, aside from the cost of capital and the break points and all that, it is possible that companies issue stock, even though it's more expensive, because there is a signal being sent by what they are doing in selling equity, in having shareholders, there is a logic because there is a signal to the markets that we can afford this, we can do this, we can be a public company as opposed to a purely debt company. Let me try that. Do you have kids? You don't. You look, I hope not. Hell, someday you will. And you know what? From the day they're born with diapers filled with turds till the day they leave high school and you say, praise Jesus, that little snot is gone. I'm so sick of paying for every... And all along the way, you know that you hear that story about how all these joys of having children and all that, they lie. You see, here's the thing though. We still have kids. Okay? But we still do it. You ever had a boyfriend? Okay. Now, you know, we are pigs. We're slobs. We're gross. We're profane. We're insensitive. What else, guys? Help me out here. I ain't getting involved in it. Yeah, you have us around. You see, there's the thing, though. Interestingly enough, and what you said goes to the point of it, sir, is that there may very well be, aside from the cost of capital arguments and this horseshoe-shaped weighted average cost of capital argument, which is valid, there's also reason to believe that some things the corporation does are not rational from a purely cost-benefit basis, but from a signaling basis, they are very rational. Again, there is another example of this, dividends. Why would a company ever issue a dividend to begin with? A company that issues a dividend is saying to its shareholders, we don't have anything to do with your money that that would bring you a good return. What in God's name is that all about? And yet, dividends are hugely important. Why? We strongly suspect that a large part of it is as a signal. We are just giving you money. Here's your damn money. See, we're so good, we can do that kind of thing. I went to a party of one of the alphabet houses, these big, powerful brokerage companies. The top executives were at this. And they were handing out the most expensive cigars I had ever seen in my life. I had never smoked a cigar up to that point that was so expensive. It was a wonderful time. They gave out food. Why were they doing that? They didn't need to do that. Can you tell me why they did that? What was the point? And because they wanted everyone to know they could. They made it very public. They made it very obvious that they were giving out candy. They didn't have to. They could have given me a White Owl cigar and I would have smoked it. And as far as caviar, I wouldn't have known what that was. It tastes like shit. And then they told me, oh, you're supposed to drink vodka right afterwards. Ah, that explains, that clears your palate so you don't taste that terrible stuff going down. But you see, they knew they could do it, and they wanted to make the point that they could do it. They wanted to signal to the people who were there, all of the people there, look at us. We can do this. And that is in itself a very strong market signal. So sometimes on just a purely cost-benefit basis, But when you think behind the scenes, what are they really trying to do here? And in the same thing, you, sir, could wear much crummier clothes. You don't need to wear something that says Fitch on it. You really don't. But the fact that you do says, hey, ladies, I can afford Fitch. Uh-huh. Who's good? Who's good? That's all I have for you today. I thank you.